to talk about some work that I've been doing with Franz Pretorius at Princeton. So what I'm going to try to do in this talk is summarize this paper the best I can. I'm going to have to leave a lot of details out. But you know, if you want to get more information, more of mathematics, you can just go there. And this all started when I got to Princeton, and something Lewis left out was that while at Penn State, one of the people I worked with closely was Ben Owen, who's a member of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, which automatically made me a member of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, which implied that I had to go to the detector and run shifts. And in the process of breaking the instruments, I'm learning something about, you know, data, real non-Gaussian data. So I learned a lot about LIGO and data analysis, and I was all happy getting to Princeton, and like, oh, we're going to detect gravitational waves, all is great. Like, the first paper I wrote, one of the first papers I wrote, was with Cliff right after my undergrad, with this idea of testing Brunsdicke theory and the effect of massive gravitons and gravitational wave propagation with a gravitational wave detection. So that was my frame of mind, and then I get to Princeton, and Francis says, well, you know, you're not really going to test anything with LIGO or LISA, right? I'm like, what? Yeah, well, you know, how does this test work? So, you know, I went to do an explanation of something I'm going to describe later called matched filtering. And it turns out that most of the data analysis that one does, because your gravitational wave signals are so buried in the noise, you have to know what you're looking for. So you have to assume you have a template. And the templates that are being constructed nowadays are GR-based. So another question becomes, well, how can you test GR if you're assuming GR a priori at some level? And how can that perhaps lead to systematic errors in parameter estimations if the true theory of nature in the strong field is not GR? So that's what this project is about. The issue of that fundamental bias of assuming GR is valid in a region where we haven't tested it yet. And a possible resolution to that, which is an extension of the parameterized post-Newtonian framework developed by Norbert and Cliff a long time ago. So some evidence. Is GR right? Is GR wrong? So we have all these solar system experiments that suggest that GR works really, really well in the solar system. Of course, there you're testing for things like a light deflection, perihelion frame dragging, and there's this Lagios experiments, and you can track spacecrafts, and you can measure if, in the weak field, at least in a non-dynamical approximation, if general relativity is valid. And you find that GR has all tests fantastically. Then you wonder whether the dynamical sector of the theory has been, you know, can be tested as well. And so you can try to understand how binary pulses shrink or how their orbital frequency increases as a manifestation of gravitational wave emission. And there's the Hals-Taylor's pulsar and many more pulsars that are being discovered that essentially test quadrupolar emission. And again, GR predicts this fantastically well. And there are no observed deviations. And there are other tests. You can go to laboratory experiments on Earth and test things like Lorentz invariance, preferred frame effects, is there an ether or not, things like that. Essentially, these are mostly weak equivalent principle tests, most of them are. And again, GR passes all these tests fantastically. There's no field force, everything's however, we don't yet have observational or experimental evidence for a confirmation of GR in the strong field, in the strong and dynamical field, that is where the metric is changing rapidly with time, say, and the velocities of whatever bodies involved is not small and the gravitational fields are not weak. We don't yet have that. And then, of course, there's also cosmological tests that I wanted to mention. Now, you need dark energy, and you need dark matter. But, you know, otherwise, we do great, right? We can explain on the map. supernova observations. I'm not going to talk about cosmological tests, mainly because I'm interested in gravitational wave observations and trying to make statements that are relevant for space-based or space-borne detectors and ground-based detectors. Some cosmological tests could be performed with space detectors if gravitational waves are observed from very high redshift, like redshift 6 or 7. That's what I mean by very high. But I'm not going to cover that here. So what's an example of a dynamical strong field source? Prototypical example is a binary black hole coalescence, that is, the spiral, merger, and ring down of a black hole. And this is a movie, a friend of mine, Ian Hinders, a numerical relativist, at that time he was at Penn State, lent me. He's now at AAI. And those dots that you saw going around are black holes, and yes, black holes are blue. And the red and blue circles that we're moving out are the gravitational waves. Or actually, there's a form, or some scalar you can build from derivatives of the gravitational wave. So what you can solve the Einstein equations in that regime and obtain these nice movies, but then you want to ask the question, well, should we be really solving the Einstein equations there, or are some other deviations important that could manifest in the observables we measure here now? These gravitational waves then propagate, I know, those are the things we observe, essentially. It matters whether general relativity is right. It matters because when you're doing gravitational wave analysis, you're essentially playing a game of finding something that's completely buried in noise. It's sort of like trying to find Wally in one of those textbooks. You have all these different, in your time series, in your data, you have this horrible noise. And this is just an example of this. The red line here is just a synthesized version of the noise that you would see in one of these detectors. And all these spikes here are sources. So you see the sources are quite under the noise. So you want to see if you can extract those sources. And the only way to do that is to assume that you know what those sources look like. Because if you know what those sources look like, then you can compute the cross-correlation between the noise and the sources and try to maximize that cross-correlation as a function of the parameters that define the sources. These analytic representations of the source is what we call templates. And the process of cross-correlating the data with the template is what we call match filtering. And this is the same match filtering you do when you do signal processing or standard astrophysics. There's nothing really new here. Right. So what happens if you have the wrong filters? What happens if you have the wrong templates? Well, one or two things could happen. You could filter out wild observations, that is, observations that do not fit the templates that you're filtering your data with. Or in the process of doing this cross-correlation, you might extract a signal, but you might infer the wrong parameters for the system. You might think that the parameters are something when they're really something else, and the difference is due to the fact that you're not really using the true template corresponding to the true theory of nature in the strong field. And this can be said, in other words, by Kruskal, who was making a statement about wild observations. And the idea here is that perhaps these wild observations are more important than the main observations you're trying to obtain, because these wild observations, these things that are outside of what you expect, could be teaching us a very, very important lesson about our theories and about the objects that we're trying to understand. So getting the wrong templates or using the wrong filters is bad. At some level, it's bad for cosmology, because some of these wild observations could inform you about dark energy models, whether we need to modify GR in the infrared, for instance. But it can also tell us something about how to modify GR in the ultraviolet. So we don't want to necessarily
construct filters that just assume GR, we want to make sure we use filters that are flexible enough to be able to capture some of the possible deviations that we might see in the strong field.
This wild observation, is this just terminology for incorrect measurements? What is that?
No.
Okay.
A wild observation, I mean, this is all words so far. So this is all the introduction to the talk.
Okay.
My next slide was like, okay, this is the plan of the talk. So the wild observations are really observations that you do not expect in what Pascal is saying. So let's say you expect to see an elephant, and then you make an observation, but really the thing you're observing, you thought it was an elephant, but it's really a tiger. But if you're looking for a shape that looks like an elephant, you're going to miss that it's really a tiger. That's what he means by a wild observation. Right.
Okay.
But you want to make sure that whatever you're filtering your data with is sufficiently flexible to capture a tiger-esque shape, essentially. And you'll see that there's a give and take in how flexible you can make your filters, because there's a data. I mean, you only have so much data and so much computational power to do this. So the rest of this talk is as follows. We are going to describe briefly how gravitational wave theory works. And we're going to give a pretty lengthy introduction to gravitational wave astrophysics. Then we're going to discuss a little bit about alternative theories, which are alternative theories to look at, and how to understand how they affect the thing you're going to measure. And then once you understand that, then we're going to try to formalize and crystallize the questions associated with this fundamental bias I was describing earlier. This fundamental bias of assuming that general relativity is right all the time. And how to alleviate that bias via this parameterized Bose-Einsteinian framework, or PPE. So that's what lays ahead. And feel free to stop me with questions. I forgot to say that, but it's OK. So what are gravitational waves? Essentially, they're the oscillatory sectors of the metric when we look at the metric sufficiently far away from the source. So this is the metric. It's a tensor. It describes a gravitational field. This is flat space. And then you have some perturbation. And right, so I'm saying that there. Now, apart from the metric, you also have the Einstein equations in GR that tell you how this metric behaves as a function of time and how it's sourced by some matter. If you insert this decomposition here, then you can solve for a differential equation that the metric perturbation satisfies. And this differential equation tells you this is essentially a wave operator. It tells you this perturbation satisfies a wave equation that's sourced by some annoying nonlinearities in the gravitational field, as well as possible stress energy sources that are driving the gravitational wave. So what does this do? If a gravitational wave impinges on a circle of particles, then you can study something called sometimes the Rache-Dur equation, sometimes one of the deviation equations. And the idea is that if you have a gravitational wave that's going into the screen in what's called a plus polarization, then this ring of particles is going to deform like is shown in the animation. And this is obviously not drawn to scale. The changes in distance here are really tiny, about 1 times 10 to the minus 18 meters for, you know, a 4-kilometer for a circle whose radius is about 4 kilometers. And that's really tiny, right? That's like 1/1000th of a nuclear diameter. So Lee's not here, but imagine that he was, and I imagine I had a gravitational wave GAN, and I were to shoot his face with the gravitational wave GAN, then what would happen? That would happen, right? Again, not drawn to scale. And those are the type of changes that one expects or one is looking for when you look at the data. But that's not really it, right? I mean, we cannot really measure distances that accurately directly. So what you do
is interferometry. Or one way to do it is interferometry. So the essential idea here is you have some laser, you have a beam splitter. So the laser hits the beam splitter, it divides the laser beam into two beams that go perpendicular to each other. And they go and they hit this test mass, and the laser beam bounces off that, and then there's another recycling mirror here that creates a Fabry-Perot cavity, such the laser power can build up over there and over here. Eventually, the laser light is allowed to go through, and it recombines, and if the length between here and here and the length between here and here are the same, then when they reconstruct, they do so constructively. If they don't, they do so destructively, and what you measure with some photodetector at the other end is some fringes in your, essentially, fringes. So if you have a gravitational wave that's going through, then this length is not going to be the same as that length, and that's interference that you're measuring. And there are several of these detectors around the world. Let's see. So this is a map of the Earth created by a satellite called GRACE. It measures the gravitational field of Earth. So this is actually real data that you're looking at here. So you see the gravitational field is weaker in the blue regions and stronger in the red regions. You can see here the Andes. That's the US. That's Argentina. Europe is over here. And that's Japan. So here are the two LIGO detectors that are currently online taking data in their enhanced form. Here's the Japanese detector, TAMA. There's two detectors in Europe, an Italian and a German one, Virgo and Geo. Hopefully soon there will be a space one called LISA, which is essentially LIGO in space. You have three spacecrafts trailing Earth where the arms are about 5 million kilometers apart. And there might be a new Australian detector soon as well.
You've covered that up, but do you know what the relevant scale is between the red and blue? I see a 60 sort of, I think.
I'm going to say 100.
Pardon?
I was going to say 100, but I'm not going to tell you the units. What? No, I don't know. This was just to present where the instruments were. And instead of showing you an atlas, I just used data.
It's interesting to see that the rocks are wimpy compared to the
Andes.
So this is my personal bias.
That's true. Actually, GRACE has a website nowadays where they've made a three-dimensional animation of what the Earth looks like. And it's really impressive. I mean, obviously the deformations are exaggerated, so you can see them, but it really looks nothing like, obviously nothing like a sphere because you know there's going to be a blade, but nothing like an oblate spheroid. It's totally deformed. It looks a little bit like it got into a car wreck. But anyway, so you can go to the GRACE website and get the information.
That's where you go in the world if you want to lose weight, I guess.
You can go to space.
We're actually doing pretty well up there.
Up where? Up here?
The blue, you mean?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's light, I think.
That's light.
Yeah, that means we're lighter.
Blue is light. Red is...
This one.
And these are some pictures of the instruments. So you can see here, this is where I had to do my sentence in the middle of the desert in Hanford. This is the Louisiana detector near LSU. Here's the nice German detector. The one you can see is a Japanese one, but that's an arm and that's another arm. That one's underground. Okay. So how does the analysis work? Well, you always work in the frequency domain. So you construct the statistics called signal-to-noise ratio, which depends on the cross-correlation between the Fourier transform of the data with the Fourier transform of a template, weighted by some measure of the noise in the detector. And the templates are not only functions of frequency, but they're also functions of some parameters that determine what system you're looking at. So the template or the gravitational wave you expect from a binary system with masses, say 10 solar masses each, is going to be different from one where the total mass is 100, and you know there's some mass ratio 1 to 2 or something like that.
But you can construct, I mean, you can take your template, which is now in the time domain, you can Fourier transform it for some parameter, you can construct it with the data, divide by the spectral noise density curve, which you understand if you knew that noise weren't Gaussian, which you assume, and then you compute this integral that gives you a number. Now you do the same thing, but with different parameters, that gives you another number. You do the same thing with another set of parameters, and yet another number. And you do so until you maximize that statistic over the variation in the parameters. And that's match filtering, essentially. Now, what happens if your waveform is wrong? Well, if H is very, very wrong, you'll never maximize this signal. You'll always get something that is small, right? Because whereas you'll get something of order one or order a half or something like that, you'll get a very small signal-to-noise ratio because essentially if the data contains a gravitational wave that's some cosine of omega t and you're filtering it with some other functional form that's, say, cosine of some other omega times t, then the product of those two cosines is going to average out and you're going to get zero or something close to zero. And then you can make statements about, okay, depending on how high the signal-to-noise ratio is, you can make statements about what the probability of you actually having a signal in the data with those parameters is and so on. There's all these statistics you can do. But if the H is very wrong, then you won't see anything. And that's why it's very important to NSF to fund a lot of source modelers, people that go and construct H is as accurately as possible by solving the Einstein equations to very high order in perturbation theory. A slightly more worrying problem is what if H is slightly wrong, but not totally wrong to filter out the signal? Well, if H is slightly wrong, you'll get the signal, but you might get it, you might extract a signal and you might infer some best fit parameters that don't truly correspond to the parameters of the system that you are truly observing. And that's really bad because then you can make population statistic statements like, 80% of the black holes in the universe within this radius have spins of 0.8 m, and that's really not true. Really, all black holes should have spin of 0.95, but you use the wrong templates and you're inferring wrong conclusions from correctly extracted data. Yes.
Can you not beat that error down somewhat, like with all the different detectors? I mean, in the sense that if H
were slightly wrong, you'd see something in one detector in one part of the world, but in a different part of the world, if were turned on, you'd see something else. And presumably, could this not be used to at least push this error down somewhat?
So. Say a gravitational wave impinges on Earth, right? So there's going to be some specific deformation of your interferometer. And depending on what instrument you're using, you're going to see slightly different signals. And there's going to be different noises in each of these detectors.
Yeah.
And there's going to be, I mean, you can calculate the time of travel between the gravitational waves. You can more or less know when different detectors should ring at some level. If you're using the same templates, that's what people are using nowadays. You're using the same templates in all detectors. So no matter what detector you're using, you're going to filter the same. You're going to use the same templates for your filters. Therefore, you're going to extract roughly the same best fit parameters.
But why wouldn't they? I mean, presumably, well, I don't know. I mean, I was just thinking that maybe you'd use a set of templates in each detector, and then you find, you know, if there's one set that had the minimum errors for all of them, presumably that would be closer to the real McCoy. I don't know. I mean, I'm not.
Well, I think that's more or less where we're going to.
Okay.
But just to hold on to the question,
okay.
And if I haven't answered it by the end, you can ask it. For all sakes and purposes here, I'm assuming one detector, just for simplicity. Now, there's two ways that filters can be wrong. Filters can be wrong because we're solving the Einstein equations incorrectly. We're using some approximation scheme to solve the Einstein equations because we don't know how to solve them exactly. Even the two-body problem in general relativity has not yet been solved, analytically at least, exactly. Unlike the Newtonian two-body problem, which has an exact solution. So in the problem with general relativity is that you don't really have two bodies, you have one space-time. So you have non-linearities there that cannot be trivially ignored. So you do perturbation theory. You assume, like sort of like in field theory, right? You assume some background, and then you study perturbations on that background, and you can do things to one loop, two loop, three loop order, but eventually you're going to stop because your computers are going to say that the calculation is too hard, and whatever loops you haven't accounted for are going to introduce error because you don't have the exact solution. If you solve things numerically, you also have error because you have numerical error, and you know your boxes or your numerical domains cannot extend really all the way to infinity, but to some finite radius, and so on and so on. So there's some modeling error that's inherent in the solution generators and equations. But those are not the errors I'm worried about. The errors I'm worried about
are those that could be introduced if we assume the Einstein equations are right in the strong field, but really the M equations, whatever M stands for, describe the physics in the strong field. And you neglect this. If you neglect this, that's essentially a fundamental bias. The bias is to assume that Einstein's equations are valid everywhere. And that fundamental bias can lead to systematic errors. But what type of M equations can we expect? And there was a workshop not too long ago in the US, I think it was Carnegie Mellon, I'm not entirely sure, where different people gave different presentations, and there were several discussions on what types of corrections one could expect. And Bob Wald's lecture or talk was quite interesting. His title was that. It's not easy to fool Mother Nature. And the idea was that you need to come up with some criteria for what theories you think are more relevant than others. Now, a possible minimal set of criteria is the following. You want a theory that satisfies weak field consistency, that is weak field consistent, that satisfies weak field tests. You want there to exist solutions that represent stars, for instance. You want the stars to be stable because we observe them. And you want also, of course, to satisfy all the precision tests, including the binary pulsar ones and solar system ones. But if you are to expect deviations, you definitely want those deviations to occur at least in the strong field or away from the weak field at some level. This is a way of saying you want deviations in places where current experiments cannot rule them out. And for simplicity, we're going to look at metric theories. That is, theories where gravity is a representation of curved spacetime, and that's controlled by some metric tensor, which is a matrix, and that satisfies the weak equivalence principle at some level. I mean, you can study then deformations of the weak equivalence principle if you want. And I say it's a minimal list because you can add more stuff here. You can also require your theories to have a well post-initial value problem, for instance. You can also argue that the strong equivalence principle should be satisfied. But the more criteria you add, the smaller the set of theories that you can model. So we thought that this was a minimal set to investigate. And these are the assumptions we're making. So
wouldn't you argue that condition zero is that the phrase of what form did you have a problem?
Not necessarily.
Well, otherwise, we don't think that could be a physical theory, right? Well, we could expect continuity on the initial data. If I vary my initial data very, very slightly, I should get a solution that should be not too far from the other one.
Yeah, we can get into a one-hour discussion about that if you want. But I'd rather not, and rather leave it for after the talk. First, there's not a lot we know about well postness in alternative theories. There are some theories that have been proposed, but others have not. And the reason why they have not is because they are much more complicated than second order theories. They have third order theories, fourth order theories. And it's not clear how to show well postness in a system of partial differential equations that are beyond second order, unless you do a first order reduction and things like that. But if you look at the problem from an effective field theory point of view, you need not necessarily require that the effective theory, right where you truncated it, be well posed. It's always possible that if you were to have included the next order terms in your effective theory expansion, that those would cure the instabilities you're seeing at first order. So I don't think that's a trivial issue, and that you can automatically say, oh, it's not what pose, and we regret.
As soon as you leave GR, well, I think I can almost prove that you don't have a vehicle theorem. So when you solve equations, this has a serious consequence. The other thing is that as soon as you leave GR, the PPN formalism, and you apply it, Brand sticking, Jordan Brand sticking, the coupling constant has to be greater than 5 times 10 to the 4. In order to be consistent with Cassini Shapiro effect. So, pretty low. I mean, coupling constant greater than 5 times 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 5. Right off before you stop. This is for the solar system.
The first statement is wrong. I can show you our modified theory of gravity, which is not GR, and vehicle theorem is satisfied.
What is that?
Chern-Simons modified gravity. Second of all, Brand-Sticky theories are one specific case of scalar tensor theories where the coupling is taken to be some specific type. When you have generic scalar tensor theories where the scalar field can depend on coordinates and they are driven by the space-time geometry, then the Cassini bound doesn't hold. But you're right. One should take into account the bounds that have been placed on, you know, these alternative theories and at least some of their reductions. And you can use that as priors to limit, you know, what type of deviations you might expect. And you cannot expect deviations that have already been ruled out. And we will make sure that that's true.
The other thing I want to say is that Einstein's theory has only been tested in the solar system. If there's no dark matter, it doesn't work.
Yes.
Galaxies and cosmology.
I said that at the beginning of the talk.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
That's okay. And I would also argue that it's been tested in the binary pulse.
Sorry?
I would also argue that it has been tested with binary pulse structure.
Yeah, yeah, the test of the scale.
And that's not in the solar system.
Scale of the solar system.
Well, the binary pulse is separated by 10 to the 5 kilometers,
yeah,
which is much smaller separations than the solar system. Plus, neutron stars are highly compact. So you have a compactness of ratio 1/5.
When you get to galaxies, you get to.
Yeah. I agree. That's a very good point. So I'm going to give you 3 examples of alternative theories of gravity that satisfy the 3 previous criteria and that have not been ruled out by present experiments. One is scalar tensor theories, where you effectively you're coupling a scalar field to gravity, to the Einstein-Hilbert action, and that if you can think of that effectively as saying that G now becomes a function, for instance, of time. And then you can place constraints on what G dot is, although no constraints of G double dot exist. Other more complicated scalar tensor theories allow for the scalar field to be controlled by the space and geometry. And in that case, you can expect something that D'Amour has called spontaneous scalarization, where this scalar field couples strongly now to the geometry because the curvature is so large. And that could lead to strong deviations in the late stages of neutron star spiral mergers. That has not been tested yet. Another example is the Chern-Simons modified theory that I described earlier, where you add to the Einstein-Hilbert action a term that looks like that. This is a wedge product, which is essentially the contraction of so it's the contraction of 2 Riemann tensors with a Levi-Civita tensor. This is another scalar field that's dynamical and involves with curvature. And you see this is a quadratic correction to the action.
Doesn't that involve higher order derivatives?
This leads to third-order derivatives.
That's bad. Sorry.
We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
This leads to priority violation. And depending on the structure of this scalar field, you can have third-time derivative or not. You can have second-order, a purely second-order theory. Another example where you don't have to deal with high-order derivatives is Gauss-Bonnet gravity, where you add to the action a certain combination of the Ricci and Riemann tensors coupled to some scalar field. Again, you can show that this theory leads to a second-order formulation, and it leads to modifications to, for instance, the ringdown of black holes, the ringdown spectrum, after black holes have merged. And these are somewhat motivated from you know, string theory and gravity. So there are also things you sort of expect, theoretically, at least at second order in Riemann. Now, another point to mention is that if I didn't have these scalar fields here, this term, as well as this term, are total divergences. So you can integrate them apart and then not consider them because they become surface terms. It's what's called a topological invariant. But if you couple these terms to some field, that is, if the coupling is it runs with energy, for instance, as well as here, then when you integrate that term by parts, then you acquire the derivatives of the scalar field that are no longer vanishing among some modifications, even at the classical level of the equation of motion, even in four dimensions. So we are here in four dimensions as well.
So there are some examples that, for instance, you can take this and you can study parametrized positronium theory, so weak field expansions and solar system tests, and you can play it as a constraint on what this is, but it's really, really weak. So this leaves the door open for much stronger constraints from the gravitational wave sector. The same happens with this. You can do the same with binary pulsars. But because this scales with the Riemann squared, unless you have very high curvature, you're not, this effect is not going to be all that dominant. Of course, we now are considering solar mass black holes where the curvature, or you know, astrophysical black holes where the curvature is not that high, but it's definitely higher than on Earth. So you can place stronger constraints. And you can, even if you don't expect to see deviations, you can still ask the questions, well, what type of corrections could we see or could we expect? What type of deformations would be induced in the gravitational wave metric perturbation? Unless you begin to ask those questions, you don't know what to look for.
What about number three?
I don't know. No. I know number two because I pretty much worked on that for 4 years.
Just get one of Ross Gauss as well.
In number
three? One, two.
In number two, you can show that Ripper's theorem is satisfied because Schwarzschild is the exact solution.
Three is, you do not get the echo for that.
I don't know that.
No, I'm sure. So,
yes, sir?
Anything else besides two? Question about two. What do you get for the Gaines and Robinson parameters again?
The parameter?
Yeah.
You get the exact GR value.
Gamma equals one.
Gamma is not modified. In fact, the only PPM parameter that gets modified is a PPM parameter that was not considered by Cliff. It's a PPM parameter that modifies frame drag in a party-violating way. Okay. So you have to introduce a new PPM parameter, which then, after we calculated it with Alexander, the people at Caltech combined with Caldwell and other people compared and did the actual test with like observations from Lagios and placed a constraint. But because the curvature is so weak, because you're looking at large distances, then the constraints are not really on that.
Beta.
All of them are
here. The lunar
rangings and that doesn't do it.
So you may be about to say this, but what if it modifies frame dragging, what about the binary pulsar system? Doesn't that put
yes.
a constraint?
That was my first paper at Princeton. That's something David Spregel suggested. It's like, well, you know, it modifies frame dragging, do the binary pulsar test. So I went away and did binary pulsar test. And that places a much stronger constraint, but still something that... and that's also something static, by the way, right? So that doesn't test the propagating sector, dynamical sector.
Sure. But is the binary pulse, does the binary pulsar place the tightest constraint on the...
By far.
That's what I would have thought.
I mean, on hindsight, that's the thing we should have looked at first. But let's go.
So two is unstable. What's Dobrowski's theorem? You've got more than two derivatives.
No, that's not entirely true because this is a total divergence. So, since this is a total divergence, then if the scalar field has a certain dependent, for instance, you can show that Dobrowski's instability. So that's been done with already. So there's papers that show, I think. Yes, other good questions? No? So, I showed you what modifications to the action you could imagine, but that's not what we measure. What we measure is the response of a gravitational wave interferometer on an impinging gravitational wave, and that's something you really have to keep in mind, because that's the thing you want to parameterize. So that can be written as follows. That's a response function. This is something called the beam pattern function that's dependent on the geometry of the detector, and it tells you essentially how the detector responds to this gravitational wave. And H plus and H cross are the plus and cross polarizations of the metric perturbation. So if you concentrate on binary coalescences, which is what I want to do, then you can divide the binary coalescence into three stages. Excuse me. You can divide it into an in-spiral region, a Planck merger region, and a ring knot region. And in the in-spiral, then you can use post-Newtonian theory, or essentially perturbation theory about flat space, to obtain a model or approximation for the gravitational wave. And at some point, when the gravitational field becomes strong and the velocities become moderate, then post-Newtonian theory should break down, and then you have to solve the problem numerically. And after that, you can treat the problem as a perturbed black hole that's ringing down due to the merger. And that can be dealt with analytically, again, via black hole perturbation theory. And there's a picture that was drawn by Kip Thorne way before I even started studying physics. And it's wrong. And it was replaced by this picture. Essentially, the in-spiral is an interpolation. So the merger phase is an interpolation between the in-spiral and the ring knot. There's nothing funky going on here, at least not for the simplest cases that have been analyzed. This is, I think, the gravitational wave as computed by numerical relativity for two binary black holes that are non-spinning in a circular orbit. If you have some more complicated orbital configuration, then it's possible that something stranger arises. Sure. But that's unclear yet. And we want to understand how the Fourier transform of the gravitational wave behaves in these different regions. And in the early in-spiral region, post-Newtonian theory predicts that essentially the waveform behaves as follows. So f to the minus 7/6, f is the frequency, and e to the I psi f is some phase that goes as f to the minus 5/3. And the factor of 5/3 here is due to the fact that general relativity is quadrupolar, is dominantly quadrupolar. So the time derivative of the frequency is essentially the time derivative of the energy divided by dEdf. If you had predominantly dipolar radiation, then this coefficient here would become minus 7/3 instead of minus 5/3. In the merger, phenomenologically, it's been shown that the Fourier transform goes as f to the minus 2/3. But there's no current explanation for why that is, I would say. And in the ring down phase in the time domain is just a sinusoid whose amplitude is damped by, it's exponentially damped. So you have some e to the minus t that's damping it with some lifetime tau. And it turns out that if Fourier transform that, mathematically you can show it's always a Lorentzian. F ring down is the frequency at which ring down starts, and tau is the relaxation time of ring down. So here you have your three gravitational waves, or the three things that actually enter the response function in the three different stages. And then, of course, I mean, this is piecewise, so you have to join them somewhere. And what you want to understand is, you know, this is true in GR. What happens in other theories of gravity? So in scalar tensor theories, because dipolar radiation is allowed, then, as I said, the exponent here becomes minus 7/3. And this beta is related to the coupling constant of the theory. If you're looking at Brans-Dicke theory, then, as the gentleman was saying earlier, this is highly constrained. So you know that beta has to be smaller than some number that's given by spacecraft tracking, Cassini, essentially. But if you're not in Brans-Dicke, that's not necessarily true, and you can have some other scalar tensor correction.
So is that framing for, so does that include scalar theories that have some kind of chameleon type mechanism, where they're not decoupled differently in presence of matter?
As long as you have dipolar radiation, that's what it is.
You know how that dipolar, I mean, how that would be affected by...
How does dipolar radiation get affected in chameleon type mechanisms? No, I don't.
Would it be?
I think, I mean, part of this talk was to start to get theorists to think about computing this object, because this is what you're measuring. So your theory, pick your favorite theory, go do perturbation about flat space, anybody can do it. And then compute the time domain, and then do a Fourier transform, and see what it looks like. And tell us what it looks like, so that we can look for it. Oh, and this is the GR part. So you have GR that times the entire mass, right? The amplitude turns out not to be modified to leading order. In Chern-Simons theory, in the Arrhenius spiral, you can show that the amplitude is modified. And in fact, the amplitude is corrected by something that looks like 1 plus a constant times f, where the frequency is not modified. Again, the proportionality constant here depends on the coupling to the theory, and that's the thing that you constrain with binary Fourier observations. So you have a prior that, you know, your alpha here cannot be larger than what has already been measured.
But high frequency waves have a significantly different behavior.
Well, here we're looking for, so these solutions have been solved or obtained using approximation schemes where you're assuming that your rotational waves are
essentially. You can't, it's within, also you can't have high frequency.
So the frequencies we're looking at here are this, so either for lag of release, a frequency is between 10 to the minus 4 hertz to 100 hertz, 1000 hertz, something like that. So you're not allowing, you have to go to infinity.
Okay, all right, right. So.
Yes.
Are there any corrections to the
post-Newtonian
Lagrangian?
Are there any corrections to the post-Newtonian, like, what, like, I mean, these are not, I don't know.
I mean, you have all these extra terms in your action, possibly when you expand them, you get also corrections to the Lagrangian.
Right? You're asking if there are degeneracies between the post-Newtonian terms that arise in the interaction with these terms. That's a very good question, yeah. In this particular case, no, because GR starts at f to the minus 5/3, and then there's corrections that are proportional with f. So the 1pn term is like f to the 2/3, the 2pn terms f to the 4/3, and so on. So that leads to larger and larger frequency values in the phase length. So those don't couple with the leading order dipolar terms. But then if you go to second order in Brunswicki theory, then you begin to see terms that are proportional to this coupling that do mix with the post-Newtonian ones. And then there you have to deal with the degeneracies. And now if you're in scalar tensor theories that are not Brunswicki, then I don't know. Then it can be much more complicated. Here, the case is slightly trickier because obviously, if you just take something called the restricted post-Newtonian approximation, where you compute the Fourier transform ignoring amplitude corrections to the waveform, then this is what it is, and there's no degeneracies between post-Newtonian parameters and that, because you know, you only have the Newtonian level amplitude. But if you include amplitude corrections, there will be degeneracies. And some people in the LIGO group are beginning to look at that to see if you can break those degeneracies or not. The more complexity you add to your waveform, the more information you're going to have. So there's some chance you're going to be able to break some of these degeneracies.
Yeah. So maybe you'll get to this later, but as a ballpark estimate for realistic parameters, what's the biggest that Chern-Simons thing can be?
Well, this one in particular, I wrote for this talk. So this is all the equals should be wiggly lines, right? So I have to go to the paper to actually see. I can give you a number, but.
I meant times the frequency as well. So, you know, the optimum gravity wave with the best Chern-Simons. You know, what? A percent or 10%?
Well, we don't know because there's two versions of Chern-Simons theory. There's the non-dynamical version, which is the one that's been constrained, where you assume your scalar field has a fixed functional form. And then you go and you calculate. And there is another version called the dynamical version, where you let your scalar field evolve, and it has its own evolution equation, and it's driven by the curvature. In the dynamical case, we don't know how big alpha can be. I mean, there's no constraints, essentially because nobody has looked at it yet. In the non-dynamical case, we do know, and the binary pulsar test on alpha, I think, is in the order of milli electron volts or something like that in energy units. So, I mean, in the non, for that specific functional form that was chosen to perform that specific constraint, then you're not going to see this. Because the frequency is never high enough to lead to a significant correction. Yes.
Just back to this issue of branch taking. The difference between branch taking and minimally coupled scale parameter.
Yes.
So you have phi times r, phi is one of the cheap. And this is a non-minimal coupled theory. This is, of course, a significant difference in GR branch taking. For example, gamma is omega plus 1 over omega plus.
Yeah, I'm going to get to the BPM parameters in a second.
And this is a serious issue.
I'm going to get to the BPM parameters in a second. If I don't get
I'm,
to what you're saying, then
I'm puzzled by the fact that John Simon's, you are coupling non-linearly to the Ritchie scalar, and yet you're saying you get exactly the dysfunctional solution.
Yes. Because the correction, yeah, because it's anti-symmetric, and Schwarzschild is spherically symmetric. So the correction, there's no party to which the thing can couple to. So the correction just vanishes identically. That's the physically intuitive reason.
It's
why.
It's a wedge problem.
Yeah. In the transient time scale. So this talk was not about Chern Simonson sketches or theory. These are just examples, right? Of some of the things that you can. These are things that people have looked at in the past. That's why I'm writing them down here. I'm not particularly putting a lot of faith that these are like the true theories of nature or anything like that. But these are alternatives that you can that people have calculated, so we can go and look for them. But of course, you don't want to repeat this calculation over and over again, right? So you can do PPN. Something called PPN, which is a parameterized post-Newtonian framework. But that, of course, works when you're trying to parameterize the gravitational field. And this is one of the parameters that you add. This is the spatial sector of the metric. And U is your Newtonian potential, and that's one of the PPA parameters. And then depending on the theory of gravity that you're looking at, you can either have gamma equal to 1 or gamma equal to something else. And then you can place constraints on that omega based on how close gamma is to unity, for example. And you want to do something similar for gravitational waves. The problem is that now you do not want to solve the Einstein equations assuming an expansion about Minkowski and small velocities and small fields and all that, because your observable is not a gravitational field, the stationary gravitational field like that, but it's a dynamical quantity, gravitational wave. So we developed this PPE. And I'm sorry I'm going fast, but apparently I only have 10 minutes left. So the general idea is that given some physical scenario, you go and you solve the field equations to obtain the gravitational wave perturbation. Once you have the gravitational wave perturbation for whatever alternative theory you chose, you construct the Fourier transform. And from that, you obtain the response function. And once you have that, you want to generalize, and you want to repeat that for different alternative theories of gravity, so you have a bunch of these Fourier transforms, and you want to then infer phenomenologically from all these response functions a super response function that enhances the GR templates via some PPE parameters. So this is the simplest one we constructed that's actually quite complicated with some PPE parameters, such that when these PPE parameters take some values, your waveform reaches exactly to GR, but when they take other values, they deviate from GR. So
U is a frequency?
Yeah, so, yeah, U is a frequency. So in the spiral, for example, I didn't want to show you, I wanted to just like flash what the full PPE template was, but you know, we can just concentrate on the spiral part of that waveform or that response function. And one parameterization that we proposed was to modify the amplitude via two PPE parameters, some alpha and some A, and then the phase via some beta and some B. And then you have some priors on how big alpha and beta can be and what the values of A and B can be. And then you just filter your data with that enhanced waveform, that enhanced template, and you let the data decide what alpha, A, beta, and B are. Of course, you also want to model generic deviations. So we did a study, a small study of what possible deviations would you expect following some symmetry arguments, so make sure you don't violate energy conservation and things like that. But for instance, if you have additional degrees of freedom, like scalar degrees of freedom, then as the gravitational waves, as the objects get closer and closer to each other, then this scalar degree of freedom could be excited. And if it is excited, then it's going to drive energy away from the system. If it drives energy away from the system, that means that the orbit's going to shrink faster than what you would have expected otherwise with just quadrupolar emission. And you want to parameterize that in some way. So therefore, we construct some extrapolations. So our PPE templates that I showed earlier represent corrections to the waveform from well-known alternative theories of gravity, but also corrections from some other generic modifications that don't particularly represent any one theory of gravity that's well-known today. So this is essentially what I said earlier. You enhance your templates with these PPE parameters, so your observable gets modified and deformed, and then you use it to filter the data, and you let the data decide how big or small the deformation can be. Now, you've constructed something that differs from GR via some PPE parameters. So you've removed some fundamental bias. But of course, if you still have some fundamental bias because you've only allowed certain deformations. So if you want to be more and more general, you have to add more and more of these parameters. So there's a give and take. How many parameters do I add versus how generic do I want my waveform to be? And you don't want to add too many parameters, because then if you do that, you can essentially be feeding noise as opposed to a true signal. So you have to be careful and find the balance between those two considerations. And I go to the conclusions, right? The main point I wanted to get out of this talk is, if you want to do tests of GR with gravitational waves, then you have to think about constructing waveforms that do not assume general relativity and that alleviate this fundamental bias. We proposed a new framework to do this that's very analogous to the PPN framework, but instead of parameterizing the gravitation, this static or stationary gravitational field around Earth, we parameterize the waveform that you expect from binary systems. And of course, in order for this framework to be successful, there's going to have to be a truly interdisciplinary collaboration between people that work in alternative theories of gravity or GR deviations, people that do waveform modeling, and people that do data analysis. And some of the collaborations are already underway with groups in Southampton, Montana, Princeton, and so on. Of course, this leaves a lot of different questions open, because this was just the first step. We want to crystallize what the questions were and then propose a possible solution, a possible path to attack those questions. What you need to continue to investigate and try to answer is whether you can construct this template for more realistic systems that include spinning and non-equal mass binaries. In the templates that I showed you earlier, they assumed equal masses and non-spins, no spins, because that's just the first easy step you can do. But now there's been work recently to construct this in GR. So if you have the GR version, then I feel fairly confident that we can construct deformations of that in the same way as we did it for the non-spinning cases. But then you also want to determine how effective these templates are at extracting your signals. Are you overcomplicating the problem by adding all these PPE parameters, and are you actually feeding noise or not? What is the optimal set of PPE parameters you need to be able to avoid false detections? And of course, there's always the issue of what other alternative theories can you parameterize that haven't tested already in the solar system and in binary pulsar. So ultimately, data will decide whether general relativity is guilty. I'm sorry I rushed over the last, 2 minutes.
Has anybody ever, somebody worked out what happens to the waveform change for the scalar Gauss-Binet case?
No.
The Gauss-Binet, you have to be careful when you say that it's the energy term, but whether you use perturbation theory to prove Gauss-Binet, you have an exact solution. the fact that it works.
To be able to construct these waveforms is very, very non-trivial, yes. Only very recently do we understand what these waveforms look like in general relativity. So depending on what regime you are in, then you're going to be able to use approximation schemes right now. If you are looking at extreme maceration spirals, so-called, where you have a supermassive black hole and a small particle around it, such as a black hole or a neutron star, something like that, then the usual way to do the waveform analysis is to assume you have some background and then you have geodesics in this background. And then these geodesics lose energy in some way. But you have to have a background. So you have to know what the analogous thing to a spinning black hole is in your modified theory. That's the first step. And the next step is to understand how point particles move, because the motion need not be geodesic. You don't know. Once you have that, you have to understand how the orbital elements change with time. So how does the particle lose energy? How does the orbit lose energy? So how does the spiral happen? Once you have that, then you can construct waveforms. That's been done, everything but the last step in Chern-Simons.
So there's an exact solution for this?
Well, there's a solution that's constructed in a slow rotating approximation. So you have, you essentially look for solutions of spinning black holes that are spinning slowly.
That's not an exact solution.
No, that's an approximate solution. So you can study, you can also study orbits about approximate solutions. That's okay too. But you have to have something to, I mean, you cannot assume you have Kerr.
Sure,
because
sure,
Kerr
course,
might not be
of course,
anything. But in Gauss-Bonnet, so in Gauss-Bonnet, there are also slowly rotating solutions very recently that have been found numerically. The Chern-Simons thing is analytic. The other thing is numeric. But there has been no work in determining whether motion is geodesic or not, or no work in understanding the emission or the shrinkage of the orbit.
And so, no analytic approximation.
For the construction of the solution?
Yeah.
Well, I have some ideas, but people haven't, there's no papers out on that yet. There's only numerical curves of what the horizon does, things like by solving, you know, the approximate set of differential equations numerically. The work by Cardoso and one of his students. But it's only four dimensions, too.
Yeah.
How does introducing those extra two parameters affect the false alarm rates?
I couldn't hear you.
How does introducing those extra parameters affect the false alarm rates? And so is it, you need to set a higher threshold than you see up to noise?
That's an excellent question. And that's one of the things we have to investigate now. It's impossible to answer that question before you have a template family to investigate. Now we have a template family. So the next step is to study that. And to study also whether there's degeneracy, because the issue of degeneracy is very important as well. And so Gehr and Cornish and these other people have begun to think about that, although those are not LIGO people, it's LISA. So you can, if you convince Brown to do it, then I'll be happy to collaborate.
There were other questions.
Yes?
So you mentioned that we should be testing the alternate theories in the strong field region.
Yeah.
That is one of the criteria. But suppose if I am doing the experiment and if I see discrepancy from the template in the strong field regime,
yeah,
the first thing I'll suspect is that my perturbation theory is going wrong.
Yes, that's why you have to be very careful in the solutions you obtain to model the waveforms in the strong field regime. So if you're in the strong field regime, really you should just take your equations and then put them in a computer and solve them numerically, the modified set of equations.
And then how do we define the observables in the strong field regime?
Well, then you take the waveform, and then you study how the gravitational waves are defined in your modified theory, say that they are defined in the same way as the GR, so you can compute Psi4, for instance, in the Mapner scalar. From that, you can extract the waveform. Once you have the waveform, you construct the response function, the Fourier transform. Same way as you did in GR.
So we have to generalize these observables in that?
Yeah. Right. I mean, yeah. So, but the problem is that solving these modified equations on a computer first hasn't been done. Nobody has solved mergers in alternative theories of gravity as fast. But very early work is in their way. But as it was pointed out earlier, if you have higher derivative theories, for instance, or theories that lead to corrections that are that add to the nonlinearity of Einstein's equations, then it's much more than true. So also, there might be things you can neglect in perturbation theory, but in the strong field theory region, you cannot. Yes, you had a
question. If you go beyond the solar system, the big issue today is dark mass, dark energy.
Yes.
And it's produced a large number of gravity theories.
Yes.
So if you try to do away with dark matter, it's an intellectual exercise.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't published my garden thing. You have to introduce a vector field.
Mm-hmm.
As well as the Bayesian hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can fit the astrophysical cosmological thing.
Mm-hmm.
As well as larger CDM and blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
However, in the solar system, we have to be careful about little gamma.
Mm-hmm.
Because the most of this theory is stable, which is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get down to the relativistic corrections are incredibly accurate, and you have to deal with that. And most of these modified theories fail, F of R theories. So life is far more difficult for people like us than it was for Einstein in 1916.
Okay.
There's a huge amount of data.
Yes.
And, life is getting extremely difficult.
Yes.
And therefore, the list of alternative theories has grown enormous.
Yes.
And most of them are wrong. They don't fit the case.
Of course, none of us are getting any younger either.
Hmm?
None of us are getting any younger either.
Right.
Something I should point maybe more strongly at the beginning of the talk. We're really concerned here with modified theories that correct Einstein's in the UV. I have not considered theories that correct Einstein in the infrared. So we're not considering theories that try to explain dark matter or dark energy. That's a different thing. I agree with what you're saying. I mean, and you have to. The nice thing about the UV modified theories is that since they are UV, pretty much by construction, they satisfy all tests that have been performed, because we don't have any UV tests here. And by UV, I mean something that like depends on the curvature tensor quadratically as higher powers. So
quantum gravity.
Well, I don't mean quantum gravity. I just mean something that depends on or corrects Einstein equations with some positive power of the curvature tensor. It's higher than one.
Higher order curvature.
Yes, some higher order curvature corrections. And except for some examples that can be ruled out from the get-go because they're just unstable or things like that.
Yeah. All of them.
No, Chern-Simons is not.
No, I mean, with the exception of that. But to me, Chern-Simons is not very interesting.
Well, okay. Ian, I think you had a question.
So I was just wondering, so what does a measurement of your parameters give us? Presumably, is this going to be measured as some kind of parameters that the searches and template back? I guess my curiosity is how do you get back to the fundamental theory?
Right, so that's a very good question. So depending on the dependence of the correction of frequency, you can infer where it's coming from.
It looks like your phenomenological H is kind of a combination of what you get from...
Yeah, that's it's exactly what that is. Yeah. And you can show that depending on what the parameters, you know, the exponents in the frequency are, then they will correspond to different corrections. Again, the inspiral waveform, they will correspond to different corrections to the conservative sector, so to the Hamiltonian, or to the dissipative sector, so like the energy radiator. So you can even sort of prove them. But then the problem is there might be more than one theory that predicts similar corrections. And then how do you disentangle that? So it's not necessarily an exercise in trying to verify alternative theories of gravity, but it's more an exercise in trying to determine or measure or get a sense of whether nature deviates from GR at any level in gravitational waves without having to repeat the analysis for every single alternative theory of gravity out there.
So I'm going back to the comment earlier on, but in fact, what John was saying. So it's true that there is lots of theories out there that are well motivated, and the people haven't been able to understand their web functions or not, just because we don't really have it. But I'm coming from the numerical camp. I'm baffled to hear when these guys are presenting their theories that, well, we tried this numerically. We just put it in a computer and we evolve it a little bit, and if it works, if it is stable, it will work. I was like, come on, we
proved
for decades that GR was crap. So I don't know what people would have to do, but there is something else that needs to be done.
But there are some very smart mathematicians that can work on this problem, some particular Princeton things that have proved the stability of Minkowski for GR, and some of the consistencies of, you know, black hole formation in spherical symmetric space. And they have the tools, from what I hear, to analyze alternative theories of probability. They have just come gone into it. But now I completely agree.
So we need to kind of wrap it up because we're definitely advancing over the time of quantum gravity thing. So I thank Nico again.